Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most righteous work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming straight at you live, Pale Stream Gang. Remember to smash that like button and subscribe, because we're here to talk about Gone and Done It.
I regret saying this was like a Twitch stream.
You've really changed the tone of it. That was for the, you know, when we edit this into a YouTube video later, that was for the YouTube video portion. Let's get into it, shall we? Gone and Done It, the world's most ominous arc title. What's a more ominous arc title? Summer Break was, I guess, pretty ominous.
Oh, there've been some, like False Moves, the one right before it was another one. Mm. Like, oh, that's not a good sign. Mm.
Yeah.
But this one, it feels the worst, because it was like we had the whole arc leading up to, okay, and now we're going to build something, and then it's just, yeah. This one's called Gone and Done It. Have fun with that.
Oh, yeah. The Wizard of Retcon says, dash to pieces. That's true.
That's a good one.
Anywho, we're with Avery in Gone and Done It 17.2. She's running, and it's not just because it's track practice for once. She's
Ayo.
Being pursued by a bunch of flesh monglers.
I think Thea's right that these need a cooler name. I'm interested if people have cooler names for flesh monglers.
Mm.
Like,
what about you've got here Flesh Amari Damasi players?
Yeah, yeah. Victoria Dallin enthusiasts, or like Flesh Meebers.
Really like Victoria Dallin enthusiasts is so good. Anyway, yeah, these Super Mario 64 title screen minigame loving motherfuckers are pretty fun.
That's a
not
good
only
one.
Not only are they immediately welcome into the canon of Wildbow's body horror monsters, but they're like, it's fun that they're so antagonistic towards each other as well. The fact that they're so kind of animalistic that if they cross paths with each other, they'll fuck each other up and later, you know, kind of, what do they call it? Merge into one big thing. Yeah, it's just like, it's fun. They're just like, they're very animalistic and raw in a very fun way, as well as just being terrifying.
There's even that moment where one of the flesh monglers tries to avoid the practitioner that summoned it, and
yes,
vice versa. Like, they're just such a raw force of destruction that even like they have to avoid people that they don't want to hurt. Their owners are trying to avoid them. Like, it's they slot into that like just a straight up monster category that you don't see very often in Impale. There's not really much effort made to try and redeem these guys at all. They're just seen as terrible. Yeah,
they're pretty gross.
When they I love how they work as horror monsters, because there's something just so incredibly like invasive feeling and existentially terrifying about the way they like reduce you to just a single resource. Like, they don't cut your skin; they like stretch it and mold it like clay. It's both so invasive and so it like devalues you and turns you into just a resource. Yeah.
Mm.
Like, it hits you on a lot of fronts in a really cool way. 10 out of 10. I want to see more of them.
Yeah. It's classic body horror stuff. I love that. It's also like, this chapter starts with running from a monster in the woods, which is just like classic horror stuff. Immediately get the tone of it. Avery's on the run, and she's also running out of spell cards and resources, so it's just a very fun kind of start to a chapter.
Yeah, right from the get-go, we're kind of like, oh, this is a bad situation. Like, Avery is in trouble. These things are fucking scary, and she's running low on shit. Although we later learn she's still got like a dozen of these things, so I feel like she was catastrophizing a little bit. That seems like plenty. Although I haven't really been chased by monsters much, so it maybe doesn't feel like it at the time.
Yeah, true.
I love this moment early on in this section where Snowdrop flicks her head left and Avery instinctively moves right to get out of the way, because we know that like Snowdrop's like physical movements get reflected as well. And I just really like that, because I guess it was just worth saying that it's so nice for Snowdrop that she has someone who just gets that instantly, because I think her and Avery actually struggled with that like a bit early in the story. Like, Avery still took a second to process what Snowdrop was telling her, whereas now it's barely even a thought. I missed this moment on my first read through. It's just really nice for both of them that they're like this.
Yeah, they're such a great team, you know? It's always nice when we just see Snow and Avery have a nice, good team vibes.
Yeah, especially because, like, Snowdrop is someone who I would say hasn't had much of, like, her own character arc going on recently, unless I'm just forgetting stuff. But, like, since arc 13, she's very much just sort of been in the background of Avery's, because Avery's had so fucking much going on that, like, there hasn't really been room for much else. So it's just nice to get these little moments where Snowdrop does get to show up and just kick ass.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just fun. I mean, like, that, to me, that's what the first half of this chapter is just giving Avery and Snow a chance to be cool and do cool shit.
Yeah. Like, speaking of, like, cool shit that Avery does, there's one moment. So these things, like, make little, like, murder rat esque hybrids of, like, birds and rats and, like, throw them at them. And it's really horrifying. And Avery makes a point of killing these things as soon as she gets the chance, because she's like, there's no cure, there's no fix, they're just suffering. I need to kill them, like, as soon as possible. Having been in the situation where you need to kill, like, an animal to sort of, you know, put it out of its misery, that shit's still hard to do, even if you, like, sort of think it's the right thing. So I feel like I gave Avery a bit of shit last week for not being cold-blooded enough when she was having a convo with Rook. But I think she holds her own here in this fight. Like, being able to put down these horrible little creatures would actually be a little bit traumatic.
Yeah. I mean, she's effectively, well, I wouldn't call it murdering an animal, but you can kind of see through that lens that she's killing an animal, although it's kind of already dead by the time she's killing it. So yeah, that's not quite right. But
but, you know, she's the one who has to put her foot down and break its neck. Like, that's not fun.
Yeah, it's horrifying. It's gross stuff, for sure. So, yeah, definitely a good job, Avery, on that. So, Avery reaches Thea, who reluctantly helps her while giving side eyes the entire way. And they eventually get out of immediate danger and hide in a storefront.
Yeah, and, well, it's not a storefront when they get there. I think Avery turns it into one, which is cool. But
yes.
I think the question this segment really raises is Thea fun and cool, actually? Because I really enjoyed her in this section.
I think she's pretty great. Yeah. she is very fun. And again, it's the kind of thing of, like, I wouldn't, in real life, obviously, no way. But in this story, yes, more please. Yeah, like, she's so antagonistic to Avery in every single little thing, despite the fact you can tell, I feel like she's about maybe 30 or 40% sure only that Avery is the vault thief. But she's, like, really, like, the thing where they keep arguing about whether they should be called flesh monglers or not. And it seems like Thea is just trying to be argumentative. Like, there's nothing there. But, yeah, she's just so fun, and all her magic is, like, really cool to see, and it's just, like, it's good shit.
Yeah. Well, and like, I feel like there's a lot of really interesting characterization going on Thea's end in this chapter, too, because, like, she holds her own very well in this fight. Like, she's very callous and efficient and effective. And it was one of those moments where I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot that Thea was, like, a heroic, powerful warrior for, like, most of her life.
Yeah, yeah.
In this, like, fairy realm thing. And I just kind of been thinking of her recently as, like, oh, that shitty kidnapper who has no power now. But, like, in this fight, she really carries that vibe of, like, the veteran fighter who's just kind of, like treating it very casually, which is just a trope I'm always here for.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's just a fun vibe.
And, like, the fact that she keeps getting caught up on the flesh mongler thing specifically, I was like, oh, yeah, she was, like, you know, brought into this world by a fairy. Of course, she doesn't like these very Warrens-y, goblin-y things.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. She is a bit fey, I guess. Although she's not Machiavellian in the way I traditionally think of fey stuff.
No, it's just like I wouldn't think of her as a particularly fairy-ish practitioner, but it's definitely,
she feels like stylistically fey rather than tangibly.
Yeah, or she was brought into this world through the lens of the Fae. So when you meet something that's like a very goblin-y name, like Fleshmongler, she's just like, no, unacceptable.
Yeah, right. That makes sense.
I also love that we get her repeating this line about, like, when I get involved in politics, heads roll, which is something we heard her say, I think, even more than once already. And Avery has to pretend like Avery's trying so hard not to piss off Thea that she's like, oh, yeah, that's a really good line. It's just, it captures the energy of these two so well. You're talking to the queen of making dumb lines kind of work, and she, like, you know, she's telling you it's not working. Like, it's not the sort of line you can keep repeating.
Yeah, it's it really feels like a pre-planned line, doesn't it? Like, she thought of that one night and was like, I'll use that in the future.
It worked the first time. Hearing it again this chapter, it was just like, oh, come on, Thea. Like, that's just tacky. You can't keep saying it.
Yeah. Drop it once there and then let it rest. I also love there's a moment where Avery is kind of showing off how powerful she is, and Thea's like, oh, you're really powerful. Where does your power come from again? And Avery's just like, oh, just from like having friends that are others. And Thea's like, interesting. Which is exactly, you know, the Kennet kindness mind virus that we want to infect everybody. So good stuff, Avery.
Yeah, it feels like Avery being that sort of ambassador that Miss wanted the Kenneteers to be, of like, hey, this is a good way to do this shit. Although I could see Thea missing that message. Like, if you think about this from Thea's perspective, like, this is almost, imagine if you thought somebody had come into your house and robbed you of all your possessions, and then you had to go out to lunch with them and you found out that they were just rich anyway, so they didn't really need to steal your stuff. Like, Avery is the Musa in Thea's story. She's already rich and she came and stole all her shit, but she didn't really need it.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting.
I think Thea's wrong because, you know, kidnapping children and shit, but it's just like, you could see how while she hasn't cleared that own hurdle on her end, she's just going to view Avery as like this privileged person who came in, stole her shit, and actually doesn't even really need it. Like, just was being a dick.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like there was an element of like depowering your as somebody who's doing horrific shit. So there's a bit of a like justice to it from that perspective. But yeah, you're right.
But Thea's not going to like see it like that. Like, I don't think Thea.
Of course, she doesn't.
Yeah. But that's So Thea must just, I'm just remembering like way back in Arc 2 when Nicolette first met the Kenneteers. Mm-hmm. And we saw Nicolette as like this big scary thing. And then we had 2.x from Nicolette's perspective. And she saw the Kenneteers as the privileged ones. And that was like a really interesting opportunity for us to sort of reevaluate some stuff.
Yeah.
And this is like a similar-ish thing where I'm like, oh, I can see how from Thea's perspective, she must see Avery as like the spoiled rich person who's just trampling all over her.
Yeah, true. It's fun. It's a fun vibe. Oh, poor Thea.
And I mean, if they hang out anymore, Avery's got that habit since she got rich off the Garrix of just dropping like large amounts of cash everywhere too. That wouldn't help.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I do hope that Avery and Thea hang out more. Now that Otis, you know, spoilers for later in this chapter, but Otis is kind of taking care of the biggest problem there. They might actually hang out more, and I think it would be very fun.
Yeah, and good for Thea.
Yeah. The enemies close in on them in the storefront, but Thea and Avery are able to work together to defeat them kind of somewhat brutally.
Yeah. I guess something we were just sort of talking around, these two have like scarily effective synergy.
Synergy, like, yeah.
Like they play off each other very well practice-wise. It's a shame Avery's just such a stickler about all this kidnapping stuff, or they could really, you know, do a lot together.
Yeah. I guess that's a shame. Yeah.
that's the correct read on what the problem is here.
I really do love seeing Thea's magic. It's just so cool and unique and interesting, like accessing these different realms that have kind of different abilities and powers. It's just a shame that the way that she gets power from them is by sacrificing children to them.
Although I don't think that's actually how she has to do it. That's how she was like choosing to do that True. One thing. Oh, actually, no, you're right. She was sending them into the realms. Yeah.
Into
no,
the different realms.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, I wonder if there's, like, just a better way, you know?
There's got to be.
Can she befriend the others inside the thing and work with them on less evil means, I guess?
Take a page out of her master's book and, you know, do it with criminals. I don't know. That's better.
Yeah, I guess that's
it's not good.
But it's not perfect.
Yeah, I mean, this is the really interesting thing, like, with Thea in this chapter is Avery thinks a lot about how she just wants, like, that nice teamwork. And in this arc where we're talking a lot about where you draw the line and what is acceptable, it is really interesting seeing Avery, who has contemplated making a deal with Massa to get rid of Charles. Like, she's somebody who's considered working with people. It's like she's this whole chapter is an exploration of how Avery can work with someone who has every reason to like fucking hate her and not want to work with her. Like, it's a really interesting exploration of how Avery can work with other people.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is like Avery's strength, right? I feel like she's just really good at working with people who initially start out hating her. So I think it's going to go well.
Oh, yeah. God. What if in like two arcs, Thea is just another one of our honorary
characters? Yeah, Thea is like Nico or Zed. Like, yeah, I can see it. A bit more, you know, a bit more brutal than them. But yeah, I think it'd be wonderful. So yeah. Thea and Avery go to Otis for an evac. Otis convinces Avery to join them on the bus ride back, and he kind of is dropping some truth bombs, but forces Thea to shake hands and make up with Avery, basically.
He's so creepy. Like,
how dare you? He is wonderful. He is flawless, a perfect moral compass, and I love him. No, he's like a really weird old bus driver vibe, but I do really love him.
You're right, he's got that like old like bus driver bartender vibe of like
just, yeah,
you know, trying to be the old wise mentor.
Yeah, but like, so this is the thing, I think even if a character is like bad, as in like does bad things, the one thing that makes me like them in this story is if they're straightforward, right? Which is why I like Otis, because he's straightforward. It's why I like Florin and stuff, why I like Alexander as a character. Like, even if they're doing bad shit, if they're just straightforward about it and they're like, yeah, I'm doing bad shit, but you know, this is the situation and this is why I have to deal with it, blah blah blah, like, I'm like, yeah, all right, I like you. I've approved of your ability to do bad shit. You've got a license to be shit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at least they're not pretending they're something they're not.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, what jumped out to me is like the text feels like it goes out of its way to be like Avery is creeped out by this dude. And it reminded me of how like Charles used to get described because he had the bad karma. And like, I'm wondering if, especially because he preys on innocence, if Otis has just really bad karma and that colors the way a lot of people talk about and treat him.
Mm.
I mean, he's obviously not a saint because of the whole kidnapping enterprise. But, you know, by practitioner standards, like the bar is very low. And he seems like a chill dude. So I wonder how much his like reputation and ability to be amongst stuff is just being held back by like karma due to preying on innocence and maybe his past.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see it being a kind of karmic, you know, karmic problem. I don't know. Yeah, I just really loved him. I really loved interacting with him more. He's wonderful. He's everything I hoped he would be.
Yeah, I mean, and he does seem extremely, like, this is the interesting thing about him. He seems really, like, his head screwed on right. He's actually chill. Like, he doesn't seem like a total arsehole like everyone makes out that he is. And maybe we're just not getting the full picture.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just not getting held up enough on the fact that he kidnaps people and sucks, like, you know, juices out of them.
Don't we all?
But yeah.
The thing about Otis that is interesting to me is Avery reflects on this is that Otis is quite other on the line between practitioner, other and human. Otis falls True. More between the practitioner and other side of that. So maybe everyone disliking Otis is just natural other racism or prejudice against others from practitioners. I don't know. Because I like him, you know? I think if he was fully other, he would fit right in Kennet.
I agree that I think he's someone we're going to explore this concept of what's the line with him, because I think he's very open in this thing about how he used to be a gangster, he did some terrible shit, but like also my understanding of the bus line, like what he's stealing from these criminals tends to be mostly focused on like violent tendencies and stuff, which is
and like memories of them doing bad things that bring them joy, right? That's like what was confirmed to be the thing that he is feeding off of, is he finds people who have memories of doing horrible things that brings them joy. And I'm like, okay, I mean, if that's your target, that's kind of okay in my book.
Yeah, like exactly. He comes about as close as you possibly could to doing ethical gingerbread witching. And so, yeah, I think he is actually a really interesting candidate for all these talks about where the line is, because I think he's somewhere near it.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, Otis's pitch here is even if they depose Musa, they don't have enough people, raw number of people to manage all the territories, which means they're going to have to get at least some of Musa's people on side so that they have enough people on their team to just manage all the territories that have been taken. So therefore, which people are you okay with being on your side, Avery? And it's a good point. I think it's interesting as well, because it's the exact kind of moral compromise that the Kenneteers and Avery hate to make. So I wonder, will Avery actually take this on board? Will she refuse? What's actually going to happen here? I don't know.
I mean, well, again, this is like tying back to that theme that seems to be propping up this arc of where's the line for you. But also, I was just going to say, in arc, I think it was 14 or maybe early 15, we saw Avery consider teaming up with Musa if it meant stopping Charles. So, like, these are thoughts she's had too. And we know that she quite likes a bunch of people on Musa's side. So, yeah. I do think it's going to be a really interesting conundrum. It's a great idea that Otis puts in front of us of we do need to get some of them on side. We can't just like dismantle it. We need these places can't go back to not being lordships. We need some of these people to step up and be good, even if we win.
Yeah. 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 It's a excellently raised point by Otis. So you're right. We're seeing the themes for this. The theme for this arc really is like, who are you okay with having on your team?
Yeah, and I mean, Toadie kind of brings up my answer next chapter, which is get all the kids, like, you know, the Liberties, exactly. the Americas, fucking even the Millie Legendres. I think there is still hope for her in the right hands. Like, that's who I'd be targeting if I were.
Yeah, it definitely feels like that's what we are meant to expect like the Kenneteers eventually winning over all the youth to their side.
Somebody Tisawat has mentioned like spread the power among others if lordships can't be destroyed. Like, I guess
yes,
others as lords. I was going to say I don't think an other can be a lord, but I suppose we do have Thunder Bay.
We have Thunder Bay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would be a tough sell though for like. Part of the point of getting the Musa people on side is they need also, it needs to be like the powerful practitioners, like the ones who have the power to be leaders. And like, I don't know how many. Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I think in Kennet, we've seen a few others be leaders and it's kind of worked out, you know, Matthew, Miss, Toadie, maybe even Rook. Like, I think there's probably enough fledgling leaders to fill a few positions there, but it definitely doesn't feel like there's enough to fill like 30 lordships or whatever.
Yeah. Like, and you need the power to defend it from the dickhead so you can't convert. Like, that's the thing. Like, part of this converting muscles crew is basically getting enough power to be able to continue enforcing the not being shit stuff.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but it's not just power as well. It's like family name, right? Like,
yeah.
I feel like it would be so much easier if they had. Okay, this is a Ted in charge, and this is a Musa, and this is a what's merely a Legendre, you know, or a Henniger or whatever. Like, I feel like that simplifies it a lot.
Yeah, true.
So yeah, I mean, yeah,
That's the question that ends this chapter. Avery then goes on to nominate Louise for council leadership, and we'll obviously get into that in the next chapter.
Yeah. But so, sorry, I guess we've been talking around it a bit, but I just want to bring up, this is where we definitely learn 100% for sure that lordships can't revert back to going to the judges. Like,
now, I swear we already knew that. And Avery even says, yeah, I already knew that, which makes me think that we did already know that, but I don't know. Maybe not.
I don't know if it was like really spelt out as like, I think I'd still been assuming that like if everyone got together and was like, you know, we decide to give this back, that they'd be allowed to, but it kind of seems like that's not in the rules. And it's just, I mean, for me, this just really calls into question what Charles is fucking doing, because like he keeps telling us he has a plan and stuff, but what, how does his plan to burn everything down involve permanently ceding all this ground to the system he's trying to eradicate? I don't understand what he's doing.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is maybe part of the plan is like destabilizing the concept of lordships as a whole, but it doesn't really I more just get the sense that he actually never has had a plan.
No, I want to believe in Charles has a plan. I love enemies with a plan. I have to believe he has one. Yeah. I just can't think of one that makes sense in this context.
Yeah. If you all know what Charles's plan is, put it in our pale predictor sheet, because we have no idea.
Yeah. I'm just back on the idea of like, sure, can you get... If you were the lord of a place, can you say, oh, I'm the lord, but also this is my council with executive powers? Like, you know how the queen is in charge of England, but also she doesn't really do anything because, like, she ceded all of the actual power to, like, Parliament? Like, can you
I mean, I'm sure you could do that. I don't know.
I don't know. I guess we'll see. Because I could see you being able to get an other who... I mean, that's essentially what happened to Thunder Bay against her will, isn't it? Like, she was the monarch, but, like, the rest of the council was basically actually calling the shots and just manipulating it. So we just want, like, the good version of that.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We'll have to see, I guess. Let's get into Gone and Done at 17.3. We're with Rona, and the first major chunk of this chapter is a council meeting. The council meeting starts. Louise is nominated for the leadership position, and we get a bit of everybody's, you know, initial reactions to this bombshell.
Yeah. And as she's hopping up on stage after she's announced, she's like already starting to bleed from her eyes. And Melissa's classic. Like, are you okay? And Louise is like, good as I ever am. And I was like, way to like instill confidence. Just like, you know, the big concern with Louise is the fact she doesn't take care of herself and she comes up here with bleeding eyes and doesn't care about it. I was like, oh boy.
Yeah, classic. Classic Louise. But of course, that is immediately overshadowed by the return of our king, Stu Mullen. He's back and he looks like he's going to be more a part of this story. So thumbs up to that. The champion. The champion has returned.
I was so happy for you when I saw that he was listed as the replacement for the foreman.
It's just, I'm yeah,
because he's so clearly a stooge as well. Like, he's
how
just...
dare you? He's a perfect character who has never faltered and never shall.
I mean, he's carrying the himbo energy for the whole of the Undercity.
I love Stu Mullen. He's my favorite, and I'm excited for this story to pivot to being Stu Mullen centric. So we can just continue to watch as that happens. But yeah, I guess everyone's here. So, you know, we've got like everybody except for the only people like who weren't here that I noticed were Toadie's friends, like Kilwagon, Milkmaid, etc.
Yeah, although Dee, like, and Bubble come are here, I think.
Yes.
And Sock Nash.
Yes, but we don't have Kilwagon and Milkmaid, but we have like, you know, Melissa and Mallory and stuff. So we've got like
everybody.
Yeah. It's like a Smash Bros. Ultimate, you know, everybody's here.
Everybody is here.
Everybody is here.
And does that make Kilwagon Waluigi?
Kilwagon, okay, if Kilwagon was a Smash Bros. Character, who would it be?
change the discussion question.
It would probably be, just based on like vehicle proficiency alone, I'm going to say Bowser Jr.
That's what we're getting in the chat too from Tweedle.
Oh yeah.
No, but I was more coming Captain from the Falcon, angle
that tracks.
I was more coming from the angle of like, because he's the only one who didn't get invited.
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, but then the milkmaid. I think the milkmaid is Waluigi.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. You know what? I can accept that label being put on her. But yeah, it's really everyone who could possibly have a right to be here is, including, like, I'm jumping ahead in our notes a bit, but like, later on, Mallory comments that it's weird that she's getting a say, and I was like, yeah, I was like, you know, Mallory, I was thinking the same thing. Like, why is Mallory allowed to be here and have a voice? It's weird.
I like it though. It's like it's demonstrating the precedent of like anybody who wants to be involved with deciding what Kennet should be allowed to. Like,
I mean, yeah, but like it. See, yeah, Franz put it great in the chat. It just feels like weird nepotism, like, in terms of she's mates with Verona. So she got more of a say than, like, I don't know that anyone from the school would be allowed to just show up here. It's her connection to Verona that's given her a ticket.
That's given her an in, but I don't think that's why she's allowed to vote, you know? I do feel like they're turning it into a more democratic society where if you care, you can weigh in. The fact that Mal knows Verona is definitely what has helped her get to that point, but I don't think they would. I don't know. I can see us moving in that direction.
So do you think? Yeah. Okay. Oh, that's a great one, friend. Do you think if the mouse guy, what was that guy's name? You know, the
Trenchcoat flash, Mouse.
Yeah. If the Trenchcoat Mouse showed up, do you think they'd let him in? Give him a vote or half a vote?
I do. If the Trenchcoat Mouse showed up and wanted to participate in this discussion, I do think so.
Engage in the political discourse.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because the Trenchcoat Mouse, as an example, is, again, a wonderful character who I love, who should be featured more, and has been genuinely helpful a few times, and clearly, like, I don't know if the Trenchcoat Mouse cares about Kennet collectively, but at least has been, like, helpful to the Kenneteers on occasion. And I think that's enough to bridge that gap.
Yeah, but so where do you draw the line? Because, okay, say 70 kids from the Kennet Undercity School decided they wanted to attend the meeting. Like, at what point are you just, like, at a certain point you need representatives representing their camps, and that's, like, what the vice-principal and stuff are doing.
It'd probably dilute the voting shares. Like, they wouldn't each get half a vote. It would have to be a bit more diluted than that. Yeah, exactly.
But, like, I don't know, at a certain point you've got to stop inviting all the goblins and school kids and whatever. Like, at a certain point this has to kind of function as, like, some sort of voting caucus. I don't know.
Sure, I suppose. But, like, if 70 people from the school showed up, that would, to me, indicate they should be, they're making a play for the vice principal's vote. You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't be maybe that they each get half a vote on stuff, but instead they are performing a coup on the VP's vote and maybe should get access to that.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I find it weird that in general it's like, yeah, that it's just Mallory who got this. I don't know that everybody else had the same opportunity to get their say in this decision.
I don't know. Anyway.
To go back to just your comment as well about how everyone's here, sort of one of those classic things where I'll just, like, a blanket statement on almost every character has at least one moment where they, like, where they shine. Like, you know, Guillaume, Mallory, fucking Sig. Everyone has one little Edith. Moment. Yep, yep. Like, everyone has one moment where they get their little character bit, and I love that that happens in such a crowded scene.
Yeah, it really is a testament to Wabo's ability to... I was kind of thinking about this during the debate sequence, but, like, there's so many different kind of opinions, but even just like ways of thinking around this table. And it feels like a very impassioned and considered debate from all sides, which is great because they're all just, I had to spoil it for you, Elliot, but they're all the thoughts of these characters are written by one person. There's not actually multiple people behind it.
Wait, this isn't like a transcript?
No, it's not even real, I don't think. I think it's actually fiction. I don't know.
You can make this stuff up. go on.
I just want to say I'm going to say it here, I guess. I'm sad for Toadie Toadie is the one who gets the most shafted in the vote eventually. But genuinely, I found myself really loving every single time Toadie said something. I was like, you know what? I 100% agree with you, Toad. There's one here where I can't remember who it is. One of the candidates says, like, all the previous candidates for leadership have blood on their hands. Like, we need to kind of think of something different. And Toad Sawyer's response is, most non-candidates for the leadership have blood on their hands. If we're going to represent them, we should understand that frame of mind. And I'm like, damn, Toad Sawyer, that's a really fucking good point.
He has a number of those moments.
Like,
he's the one who kind of brings up that, like, Mallory and Bracken and stuff are all getting votes, and that's, like, a little bit unfair given that they're taking a vote on whether they should get representation in the council. You're right. I feel bad for him not actually getting his job back, because I think he makes a really, really good case for himself. I want to see him put on the Undercity Council, like, when we move into this three branches system. I want to see him have a very prominent role in the Undercity one.
I really do think he's probably the perfect partner to put with Louise. I know Miss takes that role until Found Kennet is being set up, but I really do think Toadie who should replace Miss there.
I think he's perfect for the Undercity, not just because of the market and the goblin stuff, but I think if there's anything that the Bitterstreet Witch and VP and, you know, the chicken head that is Stew lack, it's like real-world contextual understanding, and that's the thing he's got in spades. I think he'd be a great mentor for them. And on top of the fact that BSW is probably the most stable one there, and she's maybe going to leave soon to be with Nicolette anyway.
True. That's a good point. I don't know. Like, I kind of worry that the Undercity's kind of natural tendency towards violence is not what would be healthy for Toadie at this point.
Then on the other hand, as he brought up with his representation thing anyway, I think he's the perfect person to try and change it for the better.
True.
He has that one thing where he talks about, and this is jumping ahead, where he mentions that, you know, he regrets like what he did to Pekasot and stuff, but his big thing really is just trying to facilitate change. And sometimes that is a misstep, but like in general, he's just trying to shake the bag. And that resonates a lot with Verona and less so with the other two. But it is kind of, I think, the vibe you need in the Undercity. And the good examples he gives of all this stuff tend to be very Undercity adjacent things. Like, I just think he'd actually be a great leader for that area. And he'd be counterbalanced by the fact that he'd constantly be meeting with people like Louise and Miss.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I do love Toadie. I think he'd do well anywhere he lands. I just want to see good things for him. We get into the arguments. There's kind of a lot of good points being made on all sides. We get a few different types of leadership structure discussed, and we get into a very lively debate.
Yeah, this is like where we really get into the weeds of not just like what this story or this arc is discussing, but it's just like it's such an incredibly hard conversation for them all to have, because all of these issues kind of influence and inform each other. Like, it's so much of this segment of the chapter is kind of hard to follow because the characters are bouncing around all over the place because you have to. Like, it's really hard to reduce any of these to isolated issues. They're all so intertwined.
Yeah, it does seem hard to ever get a solid answer to any of these points for that exact reason.
They keep trying to reduce it to like single issues and single votes, where it's stuff like, do we need a diplomat or a warlord? And even that vote tends to go all over the place because you can't separate it from the other issues they're discussing. So the attempts to reduce things to single issues start to ring a little bit hollow at times, because that's just not true to
complex of a situation.
It's such a big topic that's being discussed here.
So there's kind of a few different axes, I guess. There's like the representation of others and innocence in Kennet and how to have that be kind of harmonious. There's wartime versus peacetime leadership. There's how far are we willing to go and who are we willing to accept?
I'd
say just like a lot of bits.
The big three would be the Kennedy is really pitching this new structure of government, which is the three-pronged one, which is funny because I think we sort of talked about that sort of thing on this podcast, or at least I've talked about it with people on the Discord. And I think I'd fallen into the trap of just assuming that that was what would happen. You'd end up with three arms of government controlling Kennet. But this conversation is actually where the Kenneteers have to take like the OG Kennet others aside and be like, hey, like there needs to be structural change that comes along with this. Because you can see the Kennet others are mostly just going to be like, oh yeah, we'll have our council and they decide what happens to all three Kennets. And the Kenneteers have to sort of step in and be like, nah.
Yeah, especially the fact that like the kind of Undercity Council controlling the Undercity seems like it was not already just like the de facto assumed plan, which is a bit wild.
Even then, like that's something that council has sort of been set up, but it still feels like it's a little bit under Kennet above's council. It's, you know, like a fiefdom sort of vibe of like, oh yeah, you can council, but if we, you know, you're the state government to our federal.
Is
what it feels like. And this is really the Kenneteers sort of being like, no, we want to have like three things that, you know, have an alliance at the top or whatever, but each part needs its own sort of equal representation. And I just hadn't realized that even though us and the Kenneteers were kind of on that page, it was going to take some convincing to get the rest of the Kennet others there.
Yeah. I guess we're past that point now, though, so that's good.
Yeah. But it's, I don't know. It's just, it's not just like a representation of the Kenneteers continuing to push the Kennet others away from what Kennet used to be trying to be. Like, this is really the Kenneteers saying, like making the Kennet others let go of what they were trying to turn Kennet into, which they've already kind of done with Mist, but this is like a more extreme version of it that's like a lot wider. But it's just such an interesting idea because this is a very different, like generally when you hear three branches of government, you think of that like, you know, legislature, executive, judicial, like breakdown of government. But this isn't that. Like this is three governments kind of representing different sides of the town. It's a much more otherversy, like symbolic. Like we'd have a government dedicated to the others and those that are different, a government dedicated to the status quo, and a government dedicated to, like, I don't know, like violence and self-interest. And that's such an interesting, like, I'm so interested to see this concept of those three governmental bodies explored because it's so different to anything we've seen in the real world. And what possible, like, you know, sort of theoretical situations can we mine from it?
It's interesting. It's interesting as a putting it in that lens. I kind of like it as a experimental system of government.
Yeah, somebody, Lanternfish in our chat, has described it as like reality, dream, and violence as the three arms of the government. And yeah, that's a pretty good summary of, it's just a really weird new way of doing stuff. I can't wait to see how it relates, how it works out.
Yeah. The council kind of runs through this series of like preliminary votes to start capturing where people sit regarding various issues. But I feel like this part of the chapter is one that I don't know if we can effectively summarize. No. There's so much overlapping discussion and concepts that obviously just, you know, go read it again.
Yeah, we've talked about half the things from this section of our notes just because, like, this is all so intertwined that you can't isolate.
You can't split it all out. I basically just started pulling out moments that I really loved.
Yeah.
One that I really liked was Verona revealing to Rook that she had seen the harsh decisions that Rook made to let a village starve. And Rook immediately, like, Verona kind of alludes to it, and Rook immediately knows what she's referring to, which is wonderful, which makes me think, in Rook's favor, that it's been on Rook's mind more than we might have thought.
I was going to say the same thing. It's really to her credit that she instantly remembers this moment, because that it suggests, at the very least, that there's not 100 others like it.
Yeah, true, which is good to know for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I love that happens, that Rook is able to kind of explore her thoughts about it a bit more and try and defend her. I don't think she does a great job of defending it, but, you know, she gives it a crack.
Yeah, so it is worth saying Rook is a really interesting presence in this conversation, as really the most regressive person in the conversation. Like, Rook feels like the one who is fighting most overtly against any of the new changes the Caneteers are really trying to introduce. Like, people like Miss and Toady are hesitant, but Rook is really the one who's sitting here being like...
Against, yeah.
Yeah, like, no, you're changing things for the worse. And again, I just find this hilarious coming from the woman who's lost, like, 100 battles in a row. And yeah. it's like, I get that you think this is worse, but also what you think is good doesn't work, does it?
Yeah, like, which gets called out in this chapter.
Yeah.
It's very funny being like, and how many wars have you said you've won?
Verona slams it down in one line. You're right.
There's this great moment where Bracken votes and justifies his vote by saying, I'd rather have a bitter street witch than a foreman. As a way of saying, like, I don't want somebody that's too quick to violence. And the bitter street witch is like, get fucked. I'll fuck you up, mate. And it's very fun.
But then he backs it up really well, too, because he's like, no, I'm not saying you're not a warlord. I'm saying that you'd build first, but you can fuck up.
Yes, exactly.
If you need to.
Yeah.
And, so and she's like, you could see how that placates her. And like, we've seen the same thing from the vice principal. Like, whenever somebody tells the vice principal that she's shit, you know, she's ready to throw down, but she doesn't throw down initially. Like, and this is what we want from Kennet Below's council, is the people who are warlords, but not first.
Yes, yes. Warlords, but considered, not just violent,
yeah.
Because, you know.
Like, yeah, you want a Bitter Street Witch, not a foreman. You want someone who's going to try it the good way first, and when somebody tests her patience, then she goes fucking bananas.
You want a Stu Mullen as a champion of the people, is what you're saying.
You want a Stu Mullen when you've got a bunch of people you need somebody to be in charge of who you don't want making any actual decisions.
Yeah, exactly. E.g., a hero to the people.
Yeah, or you could just paint a face on a rock. Like, you know,
it wouldn't be as good as Stu Mullen. Everyone knows this. There's another good Toady moment here, talking about the milkmaid, and Verona, I can't remember who it is, but someone's like, oh, you brought the milkmaid in and she's like fucked up. And Toady's like, yeah, but she's not doing bad things now. And I'm putting her around someone like Killwagon, who has made that decision to more permanently not do bad things. Like, isn't this the whole point of what we're trying to do, is take people who are terrible but have the propensity to improve and show them that they can improve? And again, I'm like, fuck, Toady, you're awesome.
Good point, yeah. This is why I want to see him up in the top of the Undercity, because I think that's the role the Undercity should be serving. It's the place where the people who shouldn't get a chance get to come in and maybe get one. And like, Verona is the only Caneteer who really resonates with this idea, and she's the one who's been kind of diving headfirst into the Undercity. So like, I could see that being her domain in, like, you know, this new Kennet is being involved with the Undercity and working towards making people like the milkmaid better. Like, I think you're right. Toady's making great points, just not for the Kennet above's council.
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that we are talking about Verona's response to this now, because this is what's so interesting about this chapter being from Verona's perspective, is she's using each of these kind of questions specifically about where do we draw the line to think about her father. And like, when Toady says something, Verona thinks, okay, would that help to bring my father back from where he is? And she goes, okay, yeah, it might. Therefore, I kind of agree with Toady. And I think that's very interesting, because it kind of sets up the question of, like, if we're thinking about how far gone is too far gone, is Brett too far gone? It's kind of the question that is being implied by Verona's responses in this chapter. So maybe this is the chapter where we finally see some sort of actual genuine, like, reconnection between Verona and Brett. That feels so gross to say and think, but it seems like what the story is kind of starting to hint at, and not happening, but like hint at the idea around it.
Or at least Verona coming to terms with the fact that Brett does have a path forward. I still hesitate to think that she should have any part in that road.
No, of course.
But like, yeah. No, you're right. Like, I really like how she's basically using him as this internal benchmark of thinking, well, if it could change my dad, it could probably bring anyone around. Like, he's just really, like, you know, oh, yeah, he's about as bad as the milkmaid. So if it could work for the milkmaid, maybe. Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, genuinely. But that's so interesting to me because it's like, yeah. I don't know, like it is hinting at the possibility of that question of where do we draw the line being applied more strictly to Brett as a examination. And I think that's very fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, and I think just from Verona's perspective, the idea that you would be willing to, like, even if you're not going to be a part of it, but consider that, like, someone who's abused you, like Brett, can get better.
Exactly.
And that you want to enable the systems to do that just seems like a really
positive thing. Can deserve another chance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's a huge leap to make. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a good one. Like, you know, because we're talking about rehabilitating Milkmaid and jokes aside, yeah. like Milkmaid has done horrific shit, worse stuff than Brett has done, I think. Like,
yeah, it's close, but yeah, I think
it's close. Yeah. yeah. Speaking of pieces of shit though, Edith is here and it's very fun because I don't know what, like, I feel like Edith was like, oh yes, I've got a seat on the council, therefore everything will go back to normal. And she gets so upset when everyone still thinks she's a piece of shit. She's like, no, but I'm on the council, you have to be nice to me. And everyone's like, oh, fuck off. It's yeah, so good.
It's a real what did you think was going to happen moment. Like, it's just, yep. she's just doing this and you're like, I think the thing that really gets me is when she finally explodes is like when Miss says something and Miss is genuinely like, I wasn't thinking about you.
Yeah, I know.
I was thinking about Liz and Charles, and Edith's like, oh, as if. Like, and it's like, oh, you're just a fucking Brett. You're making everything about you and you've chosen to do this on the first fucking time it isn't. Like, what are yeah. you on about? Yeah. And she's like, yeah, you're not giving me any respect. And it's like, well, yeah, they're not. Of course they're not. What did you think was going to happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very fun.
yeah, I continue to enjoy seeing Edith get shat on. There's some moments where Matthew and Louise are friendly with each other, which, of course, ever since
yes.
our mom critiques Wildbo, I think everyone's on that ship train. Yeah, just so many character moments in this. Speaking of Louise, there's actually that moment where they ask each candidate, like, how would you deal with Massa trying to invade us? And Louise just, like, proves herself, proves why she's the candidate, because her thing is just like, I don't know, what would all you do? Like, okay, we'll do that plan and we'll help it with this other plan. Like, her plan is just do everyone's plans. And it's like, in this situation, that is the correct answer. I was like, oh, maybe Louise is a good candidate, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I was interested by that answer. Yeah, there was definitely some good qualities to it, but also it felt... And this is what Louise is kind of saying, I guess, is it didn't feel like she was contributing anything of her own no. design rather than just being a mouthpiece for synthesis of everyone else's ideas, which is maybe what Kenna needs. I don't know. I'm yeah. kind of on the fence about it.
In a way, that's like what good leadership often is like you just need somebody who can – like this is much more like a small thing, like maybe not in terms of like, you know, federal government, but I'm much more thinking like – in places where I've worked with like a team of 10 people, the best leaders have been the ones who basically managed and empowered the people and didn't really necessarily have to bring much of their own. Like the best leader just made sure that they were enabling the people working under them. Anyway, that's Louise exemplifies that here by just sort of getting everyone's opinions and like trying to synergize them all. Like that's what you want from that role, I think.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're right. I just, yeah, I don't know. It like, didn't feel very decisive, I suppose.
No. Like, you're right. But I suppose that's where the idea of, you know, she's going to be part of a trio is.
Yes, yes.
Like, she's not going to be the sole leader. And, in fact, she's partnered with Miss temporarily. So, like, essentially, we've already got the three prongs of the government just pending
yeah.
this as being formalized.
pending found, Kenneth, yeah.
And like, I think she serves great in that part of the role. Like, there's a Twitter account I follow, and the guy on there was talking about how you actually don't need to be a lawyer to get appointed to the Supreme Court in America. Mm. And so this guy was unironically trying to suggest that Biden should appoint someone like Cardi B or just like, just a random person, because there's too many like big brain lawyers on there, and it's like we need at least one person who's just relatively normal who can like look at a situation and be like, I don't care about the legals, that's just fucked.
Yeah.
And I think like that's what Louise represents on this council.
Yeah,
she's just the normal person who her advantage is the lack of context, where she can just sort of come in and be like, nah.
Yeah, similar to the conversation Avery had with Florin, I guess, of like, we can talk about this all day, but on the surface it's wrong. And that's the key thing that the Kennedys have that's different to other practitioners, I think, is that outsider perspective.
Yeah, it just feels wrong. Yeah. Mm. And that, I think Louise is great at sort of representing that part of just having at least one of your leaders who just comes without baggage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of conversations here about this exact stuff.
I guess to pivot from all this moral stuff for a bit, it is worth pointing out, we get like an update on Found Kennet, which will no doubt be a centerpiece of this arc, but they talk about, oh, we need to pick a path that we will like tie to Kennet, that Miss will come from. And it's just like, is there any world that this isn't the promenade? Like, are we... Is anybody in the chat or Ruben, does anyone have a serious suggestion for what path this is that isn't the promenade?
No, the promenade feels the strongest to me. I mean, it's already designed to be like a meeting place.
It's just, it works on every... The only obstacle to it is, I think Avery's made some promises to the Garracks that she like wouldn't do shit there without them. And she sold them the solution to it. So it's like she might have to negotiate with the Garracks to get them to give her the okay to do it, but that's the only obstacle I can think of.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I like the idea of the promenade. I think, yeah, we'll see.
Aziza did it brings up a great point in the chat, which is that we should also ask the occupants of the promenade.
Of course, of course.
I can't believe I was considering the needs of the Garracks, but I didn't consider also we do need to talk to the Garracks about it.
Yeah. Do you think it will be, I don't know, like maybe it won't be a path that we've already seen, but will just kind of be a path-like space. I don't know. It's hard to know what it's going to look like because it's something that's so different.
Get in one of those Pisces constructions. We'll get Avery to one of those constructions.
Oh, yeah.
Then we can find out what they are.
Yeah. Anywho. So they carry out the actual vote and we get the results. Louise and Miss will be in charge until Kennet Found is established, then the three-pronged leadership of Louise, Miss, and the Warlords. And Verona heads off to her domain with Bracken, Bag, Mal, and Mel, which are the, you know, the dream team.
Yeah. And I guess just as the last thing from this whole election, this feels like a pretty ideal result to me. Like, I was happy with Louise and Miss. Still want my boy Toadie to, you know, have a higher position on the Undercity Council, but I'm just, really excited to see where this really unique take on a three-pronged government goes.
Yeah. I am very on board with this team of troublemakers of Bracken, Bag, Mel, and Mel. They seem like a good team. I like their dynamic. It's very fun.
It's a very interesting group, because we end the meeting with Miss telling everyone, hey, before Found Kennet comes, make sure you're as attached to like the human world, the Kennet above, as possible. And so Verona goes and hangs out with like four people whose attachment to the human world is kind of tenuous at best. These are all people who have some attachment to Kennet above, but less than the average person.
Yeah.
And obviously we'll cover some more failures, for want of a better word, on Verona's part to maintain human connections. But it's just interesting that she literally sort of opens with these four people who, you know, maybe aren't necessarily the most human connections or whatever. And then also she ends this segment by literally scaring them all off. I think that's just really setting the tone for how Verona goes at keeping her human connections.
Yeah, I mean, the setup for the end of this chapter is, hey, Verona, make sure you check in with your human connections. And then this chapter is basically us looking at that list and being like, ooh.
Yeah, but wait, it gets worse. Exactly. Yeah. And I just think this is an interesting starting point because you're right. I kind of go back and forth on whether I think these four are good for Verona. Like Mel obviously has the like dream thing still hanging over her a bit, which Verona seems to kind of be forgetting this chapter. And then Mal's obviously just like a bit of a weird influence on her, positive, but also like she's almost her most immature around Mal.
Yes.
And so it's just interesting that this is the starting point and she scares them away. And then you're like, by the end of the chapter, you're like, oh, that was the peak of Verona holding on to human connections.
Yeah, it's grim, isn't it? Because obviously Verona's main human connection is Jeremy, who is coming over right now. And that human connection is forcefully severed. It's as if Alexander himself shot a bullet into the connection.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much the summary of this section.
Yeah, it's rough. Having said that, Verona does remarkably well. You see her start to get into a nosedive and then she drastically pulls up on the controls and gets out of it. It's sad, but I guess it is what it is. But it really leaves Verona feeling very untethered.
Yeah, it's one of those moments. I think, we've known this was inevitable since her and Jeremy sort of first failed to draw those boundaries in Arc 8. But the timing of it is just terrible.
I kind of have a half-formed theory that Musa has sent one of his nieces to infatuate Jeremy and cause Verona to become completely untethered. I don't know, maybe not.
I don't think he has cause to be that subtle. If anything, Marisica is doing it.
True.
But no, it sort of sucks because I think at the end of the day, like the end of the Jeremy and Verona relationship could have been so much worse. This actually goes, all things considered, pretty well. They both really handle it like adults. Verona's a little bit less so than Jeremy on that regard, but like, this could have been worse. This could have been more explosive. One of them could have been less mature. I think overall, despite it feeling like we knew this was coming, the worst part about it is the timing rather than either of them handles it.
For sure. The timing is terrible, right? So, yeah, Verona isn't sure who she should turn to. So instead she turns to a cat and snuggles with Jeremy before realizing she's kind of doing something fucked up and leaves again, which is good. Again, pulling out of the nosedive there.
Yeah, that's the thing. She has these moments in the conversation with Jeremy where she starts to flirt with just being a little bit catty. she really starts hating on Carolyn unnecessarily.
Yes.
And I think eventually even she starts to realize that she's being kind of shitty and unfair to Carolyn. And that's like not an appropriate way to vent her anger about this.
Yeah.
But this is the moment where you're like, oh, Verona, you might have crossed the line here. But she sees it. So I was a bit like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
Thank God for that.
Could have been worse.
So then basically Verona runs through her contact list. I mean, that happens right before this. She runs through her contact list and goes, no, none of these are right. Avery is the only one that she takes a shot with and... But she knows Avery isn't Avery's there busy at this time. And then when Avery responds later, it's too late.
Yeah, it's basically Verona running down the list of human connections and also others and being like, no, none of these work for me. And so she's left sitting there like alone, unable to sleep. And it's just like, well, I think we can consider this a failure to maintain and strengthen human connections. Not a failure of her own doing, but certainly a failure of an enterprise.
Well, is it a failure of her own doing? I mean, like, she's the one who keeps skipping school and stuff, right? So,
I mean...
As Jaso has said, I see, actually, in the Discord.
Yeah. Within the context of the last 12 hours, it's not like she really didn't do a great job. But, you're right, she put herself in a position where failure was easier to come by.
And she has, intentionally ranked Kennet above third in the list of Kennets, behind one that doesn't even exist.
I think that's going to be the really interesting thing because, Miss bringing this up, made me realize, we really should have been considering that, we saw that Kennet below forming changed the vibe of Kennet above.
Mm-hmm.
So you assume the creation of Kennet found will probably change the vibe of Kennet too. And that's where this is coming from, the whole, maintain your human connections because presumably... Much the same way people who are in a shitty spot fall to Kennet below, maybe people who are a bit detached can easily fall into Kennet found. Mm. And Verona's going to be rooted to all three through her domain, so I can't imagine anything terrible happening to her apart from just like losing some connections. But it's just really interesting, I guess, to consider what's going to happen to Kennet above as a result of this realm being formed.
Yeah.
Like people like Brett, who don't have many connections, like, is he a candidate for falling to found Kennet? Who knows?
Yeah. 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 Very interesting to think about. I guess we will have to see throughout the remainder of this arc.
Yeah. This is a very, I'm so excited for this found Kennet ritual.
Yeah, I know, right?
We've got,
that's good shit.
69 of the 77, scavenger hunt things, so it's getting close.
Yeah. We also know Avery is coming back into town for, was it Thanksgiving for something?
Canadian Thanksgiving's at a different time to American Thanksgiving, but I don't know when either one of them is. So
they're both just made up in my mind.
Yeah,
I don't think either of them are real. So
all I know is that they're different times.
Yeah.
Because but every time Canadian Thanksgiving comes up, that's brought up.
Anyway, so yeah, like Avery will be back in town for the ritual probably, so that's going to be fun. It'll be good stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So people in the chat are saying Canadian Thanksgiving takes place in October. So we've got Halloween coming up. Don't forget that.
The Halloween that party,
We got the Halloween set up. Yeah.
Which is very important. Yeah. Anyway, that's the end of our show.
We haven't pulled out any Pale Predictors this week, but we do want to announce that we've just added a new category to that. So there's now a category to predict how will the practitioner landscape be changed after Pale. That can be as wide-reaching or specific as you want. If you just want to tell us what the Ted family looks like, go for it. If you want to tell us how all the fiefdoms are arranged, go for it.
We've also brought back the Who Will Sit on the Carmine Throne category, which feels relevant again.
I think we closed that one off after Arc 13 ended, but now it's back because, well, yeah.
Should we add what is Charles's plan as a category as well?
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah, I'll do all that. Right,
we'll
right
add that too.
This.
Yeah. And remember, we're also running a discussion question this fortnight, which is what animal mask would you choose for an honorary Kenneteer and why?
Yeah, so I added the and why this week because we did get quite a few answers that just listed animal masks for a bunch of honorary Kenneteers but didn't give any reasons.
We can just try and figure it out. That's fun.
Yeah. But I'd be interested to hear people's logic so we don't misconstrue it.
Yes. So you can leave your answers to that in our discussion thread, which you'll find linked in the show notes down below in your podcatcher.
Yes, we're also on Twitter at Pale ReflectCast. That's where you can find memes that we make as well as memes other people have started sending to us. So, we also accept memes posted on our timeline. We got a great one in response to one this morning, actually.
Yeah.
Check them out.
Yeah. We've got some good memes coming up, so enjoy. If you want to check out the other shows on the Doof Media Network or just the network in general, you can head to doofmedia.com. There is a new show as of this week. The View from Halfway Down is a BoJack Horseman discussion show going through all of BoJack. And I know you've said this before. I'm going to say it again, Elliot. Like, BoJack as a show was one that I got very into each time a season came out. But when there's like a year between each season, it's hard to sometimes keep thematic, themes consistent in your head and kind of examine them throughout the progression of a show. So I think the opportunity to revisit it is great.
Even especially if your memory's as bad as mine, even just remembering who some of the like minor characters are was like, I watched season 6 like a year after it came out, I think. And by that point it was like some of the characters was like, I don't remember who this is. And then they'd been in like 10 episodes before, like spread out through the first 5 seasons. And it was like, oh God. So this
is the only
character.
Sorry, please.
Of all the shows to get this sort of coverage from, I'm really glad it was BoJack.
Yes, definitely. The only character I consistently remember who they are is Vincent Adultman, the best character in the show. If you want to support the Doof Media Network and allow us to continue to do things like, having new shows and doing all kinds of extra things and bits and bobs, you can head to Patreon at patreon.com/doofmedia and become a patron and get access to all kinds of cool things like bonus content, extra shows, a badge of honor that demonstrates that you're a real great character, etc.
Yeah. Just email Ruben specifically for that badge.
No, that's how you get that perk. That's your color on the Discord. Oh, okay. Get a special color.
Yes.
So that's also important.
Don't forget about Wildbo's Patreon either. patreon.com/Wildbo. He, you know, is writing this whole story. There's only one arm of government here, so we need to placate him with tributes.
Yep. Yep. We need to send him 77 different patrons or else something. I don't know. And that is the end of our show. Bye, everyone.
See ya.